gawatid and close the door. We have received this presentation, which is very, very much detailed, and thanks, Honorable Governor, for not focusing on the quarterly reports, because this is a very dynamic economic situation we find ourselves, and South Africa is part of the global village, very much integrated in the global economy, and therefore both positive and adverse effects do impact on how our economy performs, and the Reserve Bank cannot be a spectator in those issues. But also I agree with you that the Reserve Bank cannot be a panacea to all the economic problems, because sometimes we tend to think that the Reserve Bank must provide solutions on everything. And also that you have invited honorable members to pose questions beyond the presentation itself. I must say, this past 2 days, there has been media frenzy around the meat industry. It's not part of the Reserve Bank. Secondly, today's papers are carrying some reports to say we are going to grill the Reserve Bank on the loan of Zimbabwe. I must say it is not the position of the committee, but members are free to pose questions along those lines. The weather is fine in Cape Town. There's no way that the report or the presentation has referred to weather. So let's not ask weather questions. Okay. All right. Honorable Van Rooyen, you'll be the first. Honorable Kwerenwolf, Honorable Ross, Honorable Chabalala, Madlamini, in that order.
Thank you very much, Chair. Maybe let me just go straight to my two questions. The first question is on the what was said by the governor when she said that we need some form of reorganization to take advantage of the growth prospects that are there. Now, obviously, one would like to know what goes into that reorganization, but also what are the impediments, if there are any, for us to take advantage of this growth prospect. And lastly, Chair, there is a major follow-up currently taking place in the Cyprus, that is between the governor and the Cypriot government. What are the lessons, in as far as the question of independence is concerned, what are the lessons that we can take home in as far as that situation is concerned? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Can I just say from the outset to commend the Governor of the Reserve Bank and her team. I think, you know, in these days we need the stability created by her leadership, and I just want to place that on record that it is important, and thank you very much for that. And thank you for the input as well. The concern, obviously, that you quite correctly say that, you know, the world was in recession, in and out this reasons that Germany will slip back into a recession, but the crisis has never left us. And you asked the one important question, what is the next mutation? And that is a very important question. Now, are we not entering that? You know, if we see what commodities, the commodities price fall is doing, you know, it's huge uncertainty in terms of those markets. It's going to impact hugely on our exports income. And, you know, in the light of that, is the Reserve Bank looking in altering the reserve strategy because of this new mutation coming in, like the cold front is hitting Cape Town later today? So that is also going to put a huge pressure on the rand-dollar exchange. You know, I think the rand deteriorated in the last 24 hours by almost 20 cents. So, and we don't know what it will do today. So it is quite an uncertainty time we are living in. And then, secondly, unfortunately, I must ask about Zimbabwe, and there's no grilling. You know, that's the media that like to use those words. But there is uncertainty about this. Suddenly, my personal view is I think the finance minister in Zimbabwe, Tendai Mbeki, jumped the gun on this. and there is no conditions. We don't know what's the set of conditions. We don't know what the details is. And, you know, it is $100 million. It is quite a large amount. We don't know whether it will assist the democratic process in Zimbabwe. With due respect to the president, there is not a good track record in running finances in Zimbabwe. But on the other hand, it's important for us to have stable neighbors. So I want to know, there is an unnecessary cloud of secrecy around this, and it's not good for us. It's not good for the Treasury. It's not good, maybe, if the Reserve Bank is involved in that, not good for them. And if you cannot say today something, when we will have some sort of clarity on this loan?
I suggest there's a lot of questions in that, and we take those and then come back to the next round. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson, and let me add my voice of appreciation towards the Reserve Bank, especially with regards to your statements made when the electricity crisis was at its worst, that electricity prices should be inflation-related. I think we've saved the country $400 billion with the Eskom application to NERSA being reduced from R1 trillion to about $600 billion. And I think we've exposed that Eskom was, in my mind, actually very... not correct in making those applications in terms of also what the return on investment should be for the government. But thank you very much for your assistance. My question with regards to administered prices is, Governor, do you have any further recommendations? Do you think that the 8% electricity pricing, although it's higher than inflation, could we still step it up? Can we move in that direction? Do you have any proposals in that regard? Chairperson, also with regards to the weak export volumes that we experience, and the global outlook not being good, that we see the widening of export and input volumes, and the very difficult circumstances in terms of enhancing our export markets. I was in Brussels 2 weeks ago at the European Parliament, and we represented the ACP. Countries in that regard, and I was shocked to see that, except for the non-attendance of the European, of our European counterparts in the joint sitting, I was shocked to see that we might experience further difficulties in terms of our quotas and our levies, and where there was a unilateral withdrawal with regards to our access to the European markets. I know that we're moving towards the BRICS situation, but it's certainly very, very concerning. With regard to that, do you foresee, Governor, that we will have some intervention from the government in regard to this? And I believe we need a high-level political intervention. Will the Reserve Bank take up this responsibility to see that we create some stability in terms of intervention, enhancing our export difficulties that we experience? Chairperson, with regards to the issue that Honourable Kurnoff has mentioned with regards to Zimbabwe, we've seen that the debt levels can leave South Africa vulnerable if our economy declines. We need to watch our budget deficit. We need to watch our debt levels. And to some extent, I believe that the loan that I've only heard of, that it was approved last night when I stepped onto the plane in the good old Bloemfontein, leaves a bit of a cloud of secrecy, as my colleague has indicated. And perhaps there's unintended consequences. We've seen that the Minister of Zimbabwe has indicated that the loan will be for business purposes, loans for smaller and medium-sized businesses, although is it not earmarked for democracy, enhancing democracy, see that we get a fair election process going. The information is therefore inconsistent, and what exactly is the purpose of the loan? You know, with regards to Zimbabwe, we've seen there's a global political agreement. Are those agreements being honoured by Zimbabwe? With regards to the progress of the Electoral Act in Zimbabwe, what are the progress with regards to that act? Is it being implemented? And the Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission Act, have we monitored the progress? Is it part of the preconditions of the loans? And those are the issues that I think we should be involved in. Will the Reserve Bank assist with regards to this? Have you gone into the details of this? The SADC observation mission in terms of the referendum was positive. But unfortunately, all the good work was made undone when Mr. Mugabe made the utterances that the Western observers will not be allowed at the election level. Certainly that should be a precondition, that we have a very strong monitoring system when elections take place, and that if we spend R1 billion with our current situation, in the Zimbabwean situation, that at least we get the right results, and that we have no clouded preconditions in secrecy, but that we have an open and transparent process in that regard. Chairperson, will I be allowed this? Oh, sorry. Perhaps it's my... Thank you very much. If I can just make a last comment to the Governor. We appreciate that the Fires Ombuds is doing a great job in terms of investment in the property syndicates and trying to give us more clarity with regards to the investment, especially done by elder people and pensioners in these huge property syndicates. What is, however, also an unintended consequence is that there was an intervention by the Reserve Bank into property syndicates, and that left a lot of dormant buildings all over South Africa, and which is negative for economic growth, it's negative for our image, certainly impacts negatively on job creation, etc. And we're talking about the ShareMax situation and others. Now, the intervention of the Reserve Bank, I think what is important here, and which something that I would like to highlight, is the timing of the intervention. Have you gone into the timing of the intervention where you find where you finally establish that something is now a property syndicate, and it's, the definition is very unclear, that suddenly there's an intervention and it leaves everybody to lose. The buildings are dormant, the investors lose, it's negative for the country and for the image of the country. And what do you propose in terms of our regulation? Can we do that we get the timing right in terms of those interventions? Certainly the timing would be ideal if it can be stopped in the initial stages. But once you're not in the founding stages and you're close to completing a building, what measures do you perhaps propose? And how can the Reserve Bank improve the intervention system to see that we also get some return for investors who desperately need those money? It's a lot of old people that have nothing on the table at this point in time. Certainly with the Twin Peaks coming up, we will look at these issues, but the intervention of the Reserve Bank, if you can give us any proposals, even not now today, but in future, it would be highly appreciated. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. We'll take the next round of questions after the responses from the Reserve Bank government team. When we come back, we'll start with you, Honorable Chabalala, followed by Madlamini and Luyenge. Okay, Honorable Governor, you'll distribute, I guess, or delegate.
Certainly. They should all expect to respond to things. Let me start with the question of Zimbabwe, though, because I think that I think we need to be clear. First of all, we've read the statements like you have. This is a government-to-government discussion. Should there be agreement, the conditionalities, whatever the terms and conditions are, that would be sorted out between at government level, and whether they delegate that to the Treasury, which is most likely. Once that is done and that is cleared, we would simply be, if we are asked, to be the executing arm. So we're not involved in the discussions, and we don't know any more than you do, because that's not the role of the central bank. So, you know, I can't answer your questions about the conditions or about what the terms are. I think that is something that the Treasury would need to be looking at in terms of what its mandate is from government in that regard. So unfortunately, I can't help you on that level. In terms of ShareMax, I'd like to also start with that one, because I think this should not just be seen as a ShareMax question. I think that the whole question of Ponzi schemes and the question of duping and in essence fleecing ordinary people with promises that are too good to be true, and I think that part of it is we've tried to have an ongoing information campaign. But this isn't something that should simply be the job of a central bank or the regulator. It really needs to be Parliament and everybody else involved in terms of constituency work that people do, to go out and explain to people that if it sounds, you know, 2% a week or whatever the money is, if it sounds too good to be true, it usually is, and you're going to lose your money. So part of this is there are lots of these schemes that spring up. ShareMax is one, and a very sophisticated one. And I think as far as I'm aware, that is now with the courts. But your point about how these things are managed, when do they come to your attention, because they usually come to the attention, because why does the central bank get involved? Because it's illegal deposit taking. It's taking money from the public when you do not have the means to do that, or and it's certainly illegal. And it's only usually quite late, when people are now losing money, that we get alerted. So it needs to be a much more proactive approach, and I would really urge that Parliament and members of Parliament, as part of their task in constituency work, is really to ensure that the public generally are informed, because it's ordinary people who get fleeced all the time. So yes, we're very happy to look at it and perhaps in the future look at it in terms of and come back to Parliament to say this is how we see what's happening with illegal deposit taking. These are some of the issues that we face. But they spring up all the time, and our concern is that we're usually the last to know, because we only know when people are losing money, which means that the scheme has been going for some time. And by that stage, you know, bank accounts are already fleeced. So when you look at it and you see what is in the account of the people who are involved, the money's not there, it's gone already. So this is a very difficult question, and it really, the heart of it is for people to be aware around what it means to, because there's no winner in a Ponzi scheme. The first few people, it's the people who run it that make the money. Everybody else, after the first few people, lose. So they use the first few people to entice everybody else in. And let's face it, the monies involved are huge. So we're not talking about, you know, a million here and a million there. These are very big monies. So we would really urge cooperation with you, and if you needed information around it and things that we could help you in terms of the kind of things that you could we could send to you about, how does it work, what are the things that can be done, and Tlengani perhaps can elaborate a little bit on that. But we would really want to assist, to ask for the assistance of members of Parliament across the board to help inform the South African public on this matter. Let's start with the question of the growth prospects and opportunities that the Honourable Member asked at the outset. I think that part of the challenges that we have is a significant part of our manufactured exports goes into Europe. Now, that is changing. There's been a concerted effort by government, and I think something that has, and the private sector, that has worked extremely well, that we have, by and large, our manufactured exports now. The primary the shift between the rest of the African continent and Europe has changed dramatically. Around 36-37% of our manufactured goods now go into the rest of the continent. And the rest of the continent is the growth story of the moment. I mean, the expectation for sub-Saharan Africa is growth for the next year of over 5%. It's been growing at that rate for some time. And therefore, the role of South Africa as an integral part of the African continent and that growth story is extremely important. What you've seen, that in fact it's almost reversed, because that used to be the number of manufactured products that went into the Eurozone and the UK, which is now at about 25-26%. So that we are seeing a significant growth opportunity by our very location and where we are and what we're doing. And you've seen that, for instance, with motor vehicles, where you see a fall off in exports into the advanced economies, but a significant growth offsetting that into the African continent. So there are great opportunities for us if we take a long-term view. This is not a short-term issue. If you take a long-term view, because what does sub-Saharan Africa have? We have energy, we have land, which means that it's food security, and you have water. So that if we looked at it as a growth opportunity for the African continent as a whole, in partnership, I think there's an extraordinary development opportunity for sub-Saharan Africa, and which South Africa can be an integral part of. Part of the challenge is, as I said earlier, if you take the Eurozone, which has been a very significant focus for our manufactured goods historically, it's going to be a long time to get out of this mess, even if nothing gets worse. So we need to have the alternatives, and that's why the BRICS is important. I know South Africa, we like to pretend to beat ourselves up and say, well, why are we among BRICS? We should be looking at it and saying, this is a fantastic opportunity for us, both on the continent and with diversification, and the partnerships and the growth opportunities that we have in both bilateral and BRICS interactions, and it's not limited to that. With the other countries, I mean, if you look at Turkey, if you look at Indonesia, if you look at other areas, they also have a very positive emerging market outlook. So that the weight of the emerging markets in the global economy is shifting dramatically. And therefore, we need to be part and parcel of that as a concerted, considered effort. And you are seeing the consequence of that, both from the private sector and government policy that makes it possible. So I think that there are fantastic opportunities. What are the impediments? The impediments is the cohesion that we need. We need to ensure that the infrastructure program that is underway is given effect to, that it takes place. One of our inhibitors is the question of energy, for instance. the question of energy coming on stream, because it's got to inhibit growth. If you don't, if you want to make an investment, you want to be to know that you have the certainty of energy, not just for one day. You can't have a situation of on-off, or maybe, because you don't make the investment. You also need to look at it and understand, and that's why I was raising earlier the importance of why does the Eurozone matter. And the Eurozone matters because it is an export destination for us. Now, if we looked at some of the challenges that we've had, and it affects in particular our current account deficit, is our exports have been very poor in the last part of the last quarter of last year, and even this year it's not great shakes, because part of it is our exports are not, we're not getting the goods out. So part of the challenge that we have is that we've had up to now a boom cycle for your commodity prices, but we as South Africa have not really taken advantage of that because we haven't got the goods to market. So that we haven't actually had the full benefit of the commodity boom. Now, what does that mean for investment? You want to have certainty. Critical question. If you look at your mining sector, I mean, there's lots of comments made that the mining sector is not as important as it used to be. That's true, but that doesn't make it unimportant. It's hugely important because a lot of the mining sector drives your manufacturing. So if your mining sector isn't growing, if your mining sector isn't functioning the way it should be, it affects your manufacturing. Now, there's been an argument that one of the challenges for the manufacturing sector has been the strong exchange rate. And that's true. It impacts. There's no question that we would not count that at all. We actually know that the strong exchange rate has impacted on manufacturing. But it's not the only factor. So that now when you've got a depreciated currency, right, manufacturing is still having difficulties because of the market. Where are you going to? Where is your manufactured product going to? And if there's no demand, you haven't got the product to sell. So that part of the challenge that we have around this is there are opportunities, but we've got to think much more long-term, create the certainty that we need, and the certainty is about policy, the certainty is about your electricity supply, the certainty is about all of these kinds of issues that you have to take into account. What is your input cost and how is that growing? If we looked at the question of independence and the challenges in Cyprus, I mean, Cyprus is a pretty unique case. So, you know, part of it is, again, part of the Eurozone. If you look at the Eurozone, you've got national governors, but it's the ECB that really has the weight and the decision-making around what happens in the Eurozone, both specifically in Europe more broadly. So the challenge for independence, for me, is about ensuring, as I said earlier, that the independence of the central bank is how you exercise your decision of an interest rate. Now, in the Eurozone, the ECB does that, not the individual governors. With the Eurozone, that's part of the challenge the Eurozone has, is they do not have the flexibility around depreciation or setting other rates. So there's a lot of lessons from Cyprus, but I think it's much more about the certainty of regulation, the certainty of what you can do, and who dictates. And the real challenge for us is not to get into that mess as a country. You don't want to get into a mess that other people can tell you what to do. Right? That's what I would suggest that we really do recognize. If we looked at the points you made, Honorable Kunhoff, about the next mutation, I'm not sure whether it's simply about commodities. Don't forget, all of these things, as you're mutating, the challenge for me is that the mutation doesn't remove one of the others. They're all present. So what you're having is that if you have a systemic banking, the Cyprus issue becomes back to your systemic banking problem. It hasn't materialized. The whole question of the Basel III implementation, which Nkosana can deal with and elaborate on a little bit, but your Basel III is about addressing the concerns. You're looking at consolidation. You're looking at what you need. What do we have today in your banking sector? You actually have greater concentration than when the crisis started. There are fewer banks, and they're bigger. So the question about too big to fail becomes another story. So you're looking at all of these things in regulation that have challenges with unintended consequences. So now we're looking at whether you can break up these big banks. How would you break it up? What would it mean to break it up? If we have that, but right now you've actually got greater concentration among fewer banks, and therefore the systemic issues have not gone away. So when we're looking at a mutation, the question is that it's in addition. It's not like this is now substituted and that problem has gone away. We've now got them all. And that's the challenge, because as you are addressing one, the other one gets affected. So part of the question for me around this mutation has to be, space has been created by the initiatives taken largely by central banks for governments and policymakers to take decisions and implement them. And what has happened is that every time they come into that, what do? They call another meeting. So by and large, you've had a situation in which the space created to take decisions, and they're hard decisions. There's no simple decision here. There's no simple outcome. These are very tough conditions. So part of the challenge that you've got is how do you rebuild the trust and confidence? If you look at the events overnight, they're primarily a result of what was an expectation of China, and it didn't materialize. Shows you how fragile the system is. And that's, to me, the really big question. Exchange rate impact, I'm going to ask Chris to deal with. Energy prices and NERSA, I think that's important. I think they've done a very sound job, and I'm sure you've had them before you to come and explain from NERSA and ESCOM, but it is about what is sustainable. But we do need to have certainty on energy. And certainty on energy isn't about, you know, as long as it's not there, you're not going to get the investments that you require. And are the alternatives, are there, and that's part of the challenge that we've got, is to look creatively at it. And I think question the choices about energy. What is the basis of going nuclear? That's something that the country should debate, in my view. So we do have choices, and green energy is something that we really do have to look at. In terms of admin prices, I think what we're raising is not the specific price per item, is that you have consistently, whether it is about education, whether it is about healthcare, whether it is about energy, you've got administered prices which government has a role in setting that are well above the inflation target band, and therefore impact. And it's up to those different sectors to say, if we're serious about containing inflation and having a... Because these things impact on all of us. If health costs rise the way they do, if education costs rise the way they do, they're going to impact on your inflationary outcome. And that means a different policy response to what the country may well be saying, well, this is what we would like to do, but that's what we have to do. So it's part of the challenge that we have. We don't have specific recommendations that I would make here. What we do is engage with those bodies on an ongoing basis to say this is the economic implications of what you're doing, so that we try to utilize our analysis and our information in an engagement with the different sectors around what the implications are of where the prices and the choices that they have. Export weakness. Look, that's the reality that you have at the moment, and part of it is that's why we said there are some South African-specific idiosyncratic issues. The fact that we have not been able to get the goods to market, the fact that we've had the wave of strikes, what is affecting the confidence levels? It's government, business, labor relations. It's what is happening in that field. If you have a look at it, people say education is your top priority. What is happening in the country around education? Is there a consensus about education being a priority or about your getting your goods out of the ground? Absolutely. Beneficiation, yes. It's a big factor. We need to look at that. But my question would be, do you ask the miners to beneficiate, or do you create the environment for the products to be beneficiated? Right? South African miners are superb. We can go to Chile and help them rescue. Yeah? But I wouldn't ask you to ask a gold miner to beneficiate. I'm not sure they know what to do with that. That's not what their core business is. They're engineers. You know, they understand rocks. They understand other things. Create the environment where beneficiation takes place, absolutely. But I think that therefore we've got to look at how we add value, but make that an environment that creates that opportunity. And those are the ones I would address, but perhaps you'd like to add. And Zodra, anything on the reserves you'd like to add? Fengani, on the Ponzi schemes and perhaps on credit extension.
Sure. Well, I think just on the RAND and I guess related to reserves, that question seemed to me flowed out of the question of mutation of the crisis. And so I guess I would I would look at it that way. The general policy on the reserves and the rand is to build reserves over time when we've got the financing to do so. And we have some benchmarks on how reserve buildup is done over time. So how we assess what the level of reserves tells us and tells the rest of the world in macroeconomic terms about the state of the economy. And then the rand floats, and I think in relation to crisis and potential for commodity prices to decline, that ability of the rand to depreciate and present itself as a shock absorber for the rest of the real economy is a very important kind of function of the policy that we've got. If you were like Cyprus and you experience a series of economic shocks and your currency can't move like Cyprus's can't, then you present very large solvency problems. You can't make payments. So for South Africa, the fact that the rand actually will depreciate when a negative economic shock hits means that that we can continue to function as an economy. There is not a limit placed on our ability to pay non-residents any amounts we owe them, and so the shock of the external shock doesn't actually transmit into the real economy of South Africa. So I think that's quite an important just kind of general function of the policy as it is.
To add to what Chris has said, in general, the bank and to some extent the government accumulates reserves at the time when it is able to finance them. Because what it means is that each time you buy a single dollar, you need to put into the market at current rates about 9 rands. And at the same time, to make sure that the market is not flooded with rand, you have to have instruments that are equivalent to what you've put into the market to mop up that excess liquidity. So for South Africa, the process of accumulating reserves is a very expensive exercise. Simultaneously, when you invest those reserves with rates in industrialized countries being so low, we get almost zero for those reserves when we've invested them. But be that as it may, at the current levels at which we are, we at least are more or less at the same level as many of our peer countries, similarly rated countries. It is not like, let's say, 8-9 years ago where we stuck out as a sore thumb regarding the level of reserve that we have. In addition, in this environment, there are very few opportunities for South Africa regarding foreign direct investment, because it is at times like those that the bank was able to take some reserves. But in the current environment, there have been few cases of foreign direct investment into South Africa. To also talk about the issue that was raised by the Honorable Parliamentarian, in respect of commodity prices, it is it underscores the level of nervousness in the market, because the level of growth there, in China is still very high at 7%, as the governor said. But any move away from what the market expects then results in high volatility in commodity prices and in the exchange rate. So a lot of it is just underscores the negative perception in the market, negativity and nervousness in the market.
Thanks, Governor. I just want to add, mine is not a direct response to any question, just to add to what Chris has said about credit extension in the past. It looks, if you look at the numbers, Chris, can I ask you to go back to that number that compares unsecured lending to home loans? But the point I want to make here, Honorable Chairperson, is that these numbers can tend to be exaggerated if you look at them at the graph.
Yeah, this one. This one. Thank you. They tend to be exaggerated if you look at the metagraph, and it looks like there's a lot of uncontrolled credit exposure into the unsecured market. I just want to make 3 points. The first point is that the numbers that Chris showed are not just credit exposure to the low-income market. They include overdraft, credit card, as well as lending to the SMEs as well. So it's not just lending to the low-income people. The second point I'd like to make is that the total gross credit exposure is about 450 billion rand to that market as a whole. So the low income, the middle income, as well as to the different asset classes like the credit cards and the overdraft. But the total banking system as a whole was about 3.6 trillion rands in December 2012. So this is just over a little bit over 1% of the total market. So it's really not a trend mesh. The last point as well is that there has been a lot of credit extension happening to the corporate sector as well. The total credit exposure to the retail market was about 1.4 trillion. And to the corporates about 2 trillion, but then to the other banks and securities firms in the asset management about 800 billion. So altogether over 2 trillion has been extended to the corporate sector. The only point I want to make is, Chris, can you just go to the next one? No, the other way. This one. The only point I want to make on this one is that if you look at the blue bars there, these are your this mortgage exposure into the retail markets, into the households, and then the red is largely the unsecured loans, which covers for the low income and so on. You will see a very increasing spike into the red bars, but the blue bars has remained relatively flat. So what this tells you is that even though there is credit extension, even in the middle of a financial crisis in the world, in South Africa, there is positive lending that's taking place. It's just happening into a different asset class. The mortgages had increased from about 2004 before the crisis, and then they flattened out from about 2007 flat. There has not been any further extension. But what has increased rather substantially has been these unsecured loans, both to the middle income as well as to the low income. So perhaps the kind of discussion we should be having is whether this level of credit extension that's taking place is taking place in the areas that we want them from the policy point of view. Mortgage loans happen to be the most stable in the banking assets of any in the banking assets now, but we see that that has flattened out, and then where the asset classes that carries a higher risk weight in the unsecured lending has been the one that has been increasing. So even though it shows the rate of growth in unsecured lending that's very high, it is still very relatively small in relation to the total credit extension. Thanks.
In relation to this issue around property syndication, pyramid schemes and Ponzi's, I think the governor has covered it, but suffice to say that in the main, the bank gets involved when people have lost money, but only after a while, because we do need to investigate whether these schemes have contravened the Banks Act, because we only get to act if the business that they are doing is really that of deposit taking. Our view in the matter, because you'll see that it deals with both the sophisticated and the vulnerable in the society, and maybe your biggest interest will be the vulnerable in the society, which is pensioners, people in the rural areas, and you'll know of a recent one that we're currently in court with, and so I'm not going to go into details on that. So our view is to say an aware public is a first line of defense. So whilst we're going for these schemes, we're as well putting out substantial material out there for the public to be aware that anyone that is unregistered, either with the FSB or the credit regulator or the Reserve Bank, if you put your money with those, you are bound to lose that money. And a lot of people are currently losing money. And these things tend to move from areas to areas. So the current flavor is Limpopo. So you find that a lot of people are losing money in Limpopo. The next part was KwaZulu-Natal. When we attacked those, they moved from there. So they tend to mutate. The modus operandi is the same, but the names become very different. If you close one, the other one comes up somewhere else. Judith?
Thanks, okay, let me start by the last comment on the issue of Ponzi scheme. Honorable Mteka says it might be difficult for also parliamentarians in the oversight in the constituency to able to educate because he also is also a victim. So I wanted to highlight that, Chairperson, that in educating the issue of the Ponzi scheme, it might also prove difficult because members are also victims of the Ponzi scheme. But nonetheless, let me acknowledge or rather thank the governor, specifically on the issue of the banknotes. One had not got the opportunity to comment you in person to say indeed the issue of transformation, we can see it in the industry and the issue of the rent, and also to check whether it's really competing the global economy. But having said that, my problem is the issue around the commodity prices, but of course the issue of the importing activity, I'm very worried about the situation. In that you just mentioned that our issue is that we don't have ability to manufacture so that we're able to take out. But we have a situation where as much as China is growing, it's assisting in our economy, but also them coming inside the country with their own imports, we have not bought the imports. So I would want to find out the benefit from us there of considering our currency in that level, because for them it's cheaper for them to put it in here, large amounts of quantities, and it's sold and they make a lot of money and it goes out to them or to their banks that it benefits. And it's the second part of the question to say that do they also bank with us? Do we have a regulation? I'm not too sure where we are sitting with the Reserve Bank, where in those type of countries that are utilizing or rather coming into the countries, do we also enforce some regulation to say they need to also have economic activity in our banking system rather than them chipping and working with their own banking system? That's the first one. The second question is on the issue of the BRICS. I think, Governor, you've mentioned issues around the issue of central bank, that we need to locate and be able to give much definition to the role, because there's a lot of expectation in terms of what it's able to do. But now I just want to find out from where you are sitting around the issue of the BRICS summit that took place, that there was that, or rather an agreement resolution on the issue of the us establishing that type of a central bank. One is that if we were to host it, because we know the issue is still around the issue of the hosting nation, who's going to be the hosting nation, but would we see much benefit around doing that? But secondary, would we take opportunity to be able to push issues such as your currency and the exchange rate and the issue of the inflation around those type of issues? Because we are sitting with big giants as much as, British, China, and so forth, and these other countries. So I'm just saying that as South Africa, do we see that, you know, so that we don't end up being in the too big to fail with, you know, imitation that we're talking about. The last question, Chairperson, it's on the issue of the infrastructure. I'm quite worried around the issue of the infrastructure plan. We have, you know, for us to realize that infrastructure plan that we're talking about, we need to have in materials that we produce. My worry is that at the rate of the pricing and the issue of us exporting and importing, I'm worried that we might not be able to realize that, but we might realize that depending on therefore what is it that we do to ensure that that activity happens. So I'm just saying that on the issue of infrastructure, I'm seeing a trouble around that. Do we say where we are sitting for us to be able to import a lot of quantities, are we going to be realizing our plans? You mentioned issues around the debt in the GDP. The issue of the ratio, then you said that it needs to be resolved within a time period, and the consequences what we are facing now is this high unemployment that we are talking about. The question therefore becomes, we've got too much policy, you've emphasized on the policy, the danger of the policy not being realized, not being implemented. and it gets, you know, investors don't have confidence in us in the future. That's what happens. And where we are sitting, we've got a lot of policy and tight regulation as well. It also, or rather legislation, takes away the investment. So I'm just saying that where we are sitting, that the issue, can you overemphasize the issue of us resolving around the issues of policies, then we are able to implement this. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you to the Governor and the team. Chair, the Governor has actually answered most of my questions except one question, which Zodwa touched but didn't give the clarity on it. It's about the foreign direct investment and the private sector investment. That's why I need the clarity. With the foreign direct investment, Governor, I would love to have more information, because they've got Chris next to you who is doing research, who is supposed to furnish you with the data that is saying, look, we are not having what we are expecting as far as the foreign direct investment is concerned due to these reasons. These are the problems that we are facing, so that we are able to say, okay, if these are the problems, these are going to be the solutions. But for now, the bank doesn't help us to understand on that aspect, which means you need to give Chris more work to do. And secondly, the private sector investment. If you look at our fourth quarter in 2012, we were sitting on 3.8% private sector capital investment. Where are we sitting? Looking at what has happened with Medupa. Are we going down, or are we sustaining it, or are we increasing? That's all. But the rest of the question we answered, Chair. Thank you. Or maybe last Chair. Another way to increase, you know, confidence and trust. This has been highlighted even by the Minister of Finance, and we are hearing it as a committee quite often, but we don't hear what actually the government, I mean, the bank is doing about it. What do we need to do? Because it is a serious problem. If there is no confidence or trust by the internationals or by the other countries to South Africa, we are not going to go anywhere. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is on the sluggish economic growth both globally and domestically, and also the fact that the monetary policy, being mindful of the need to support growth up to this end, and the fact that South Africa has the lowest nominal policy interest. My question is straightforward, Chairperson. In the sense that one will be foreseeing a situation whereby these effects will have a problem with regard to infrastructural spending or development. The former MEC for financing the Eastern Cape 7 years ago, and confirmed by the current treasurer nationally with regards to, rather than postponing service delivery on the basis that the economy is like this, you rather borrow for infrastructural spending. You can't postpone service delivery because of the escalation of prices. And I also belong into that school of thought, Governor. So what will be your view around that? Because as government, we want to ensure that there is no more postponement of the delivery of services, especially on infrastructure, where we have a huge backlog. Thank you, Chair.
Sorry, Chair. Thanks, Chair.
as an ordinary member, an ordinary person in the street. I'm not part of this finance committee, but I would like to know just a few things. The governor made mention of the fact that we've got fewer banks in South Africa than any other countries. Is it an advantage to us or is it a disadvantage? Because all that I know that if whatever business doesn't have competition, they do whatever they like. I'm just an ordinary person. I would like to know more about that. Would it be much better if we had more banks? Why I'm asking this is that, you know, you bank with this bank and then you go to the next one to find out that they are almost having the same policies, and it really affects us as people on the street. Secondly, it's about the my question was around the policy around the international, like for instance, the Chinese. They come to South Africa. When we go there and buy as ordinary people, we pay the VAT. What policy do we have to make sure that they pay back to the government? And do they bank with our banks? That is point number one. Do they bank like the Pakistanians? We are not too sure whether they really bank with us. All what I know is that their monies are taken back to their own countries. What policies do you have around that? And really, do you have people to monitor that on the ground? Because we go around the country, we come to some places, and we are told that they could have bought some groceries for some projects, but they found that that particular store doesn't pay the tax to our own country, and it really leaves me wondering what our policies are and how do we monitor that with our own people. Lastly, is about the coming infrastructure project in our country. This, as you indicated, that we have got more imports than the exports. The point is we've got still imported more from China, and yet we've got I think we've got mines, steel mines in our country, and I'm saying we export raw material to the outside countries, and then when it comes back to South Africa, it's very expensive. That's my
Sorry, Governor, I have to take this round.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, let me join the bandwagon thanking the Governor for the input, nice, because some of us are not sitting on this committee, but it's quite interesting to understand some of the issues. But I'll ask stupid questions as a person who's not sitting in the committee. Firstly, I heard the Governor asking a saying about the pedestrian growth in South Africa. That's how we're surviving. What if she can expatiate, what's that? Is it because is that growth is that the one which allows us to become the lowest nominal policy interest rates in 3 decades? Does that policy contribute to that or what? Because I want to be clear on that. My second question is on the banks. I heard the governor mentioning the banks that they don't talk to each other, but the Reserve Bank does everything for them. Now, I want to know about the small banks, because we're having major banks here in South Africa, I'm sure about four, but there are those small banks. What is the Reserve Bank doing about such banks like Capitec and the others? My last question is on the imports and the exports, that we importing more than exporting more. What is the problem? Because when I see Brazil, for instance, in Brazil, their
bringing in their chicken here, yet you are having enough chicken here. What is the problem? Why don't we export chicken than Brazil to bring it in South Africa? Thank you.
What to you? Oh.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Governor. Governor, as one of the Stokvel groups in Limpopo, I'm one of them. I'm one of the chairperson of one of the Stokvels. What impact are we making to South African economy, whether registered or not registered? Thank you.
Over to you, Governor.
Perhaps I'll start with some, and colleagues, please, you'll all add. First of all, just to say to there's no such thing as a stupid question. There may be stupid answers, but there's no stupid question. Because the reality is you're expressing what concerns you. So it's very important that you feel free to do that in because your concerns are things that we need to be aware of and listen to. So there's no such thing. Perhaps just to take some of the questions, and colleagues will also do that. Your Stokvel group, I think that Stokvels are an underestimated role, because what you're doing is creating savings. You're pooling resources and you're finding ways to use it. So can that model be used more extensively? Are there ways to expand it? I think those are great opportunities. So I think that, for me, the Stokvels give you something that, and why does it work? Because you know each other, right? There's a trust that's built because you know each other. So nobody defaults, okay, by and large. Nobody runs away with the purse. So I think there are lessons in the Stokvels, and I think that Nkosana perhaps could add, but part of what we've been looking at is, are there ways of expanding in a much more narrow definition, community banking, cooperative banking. So to make it, is there a way that Stokvels could move into cooperative banking, for instance? Are there things like that that could be done? And I'll ask Nkosana perhaps just to give you some ideas about what we're doing around cooperative banking and how that works in relation to that. If we had to look at the question that you raised about fewer banks, South Africa doesn't have fewer banks. In actual fact, South Africa is one of the few countries in the whole world during this crisis that has not had a banking crisis. We have not had to support our banks. We've not had to add liquidity. We are one of the few countries in the world. It's ourselves, Australia, Canada, that have not had a banking crisis, and obviously the other countries as well, but by and large. So our banking system is sound. And the second part of that is that one of the challenges of why that regulatory reform is looking at is what they used to call light-touch regulation. That it was basically something that was a very, that the banks, the market would act and the banks would act, and regulation just needs to be light-touch. South Africa's never had light-touch regulation. We actually have regulation, on-site supervision, and quite intrusive. So a lot of the measures that are being done around the regulatory reform, South Africa already has in place. So we're not complacent by any means. We are looking at regulatory reform to see how we can improve it. But we've not had the problems of the advanced economies. And I'd again ask Nkosana just to talk a little bit about the regulatory reform program and the Basel III implementation that we need to look at. So do we need more competition? Competition is always healthy. But what we've seen, as I said, over the global crisis is, because of the crisis, you've had greater consolidation. South Africa, we've created the environment in which you can have all kinds of banking. But our banks are very strong, so it's not easy for foreign banks to come in. So what you see is that they can't have local banks in terms of that. And then your banks like Capitec or African Bank that are at a different segment of the economy, they've been doing extremely well. So without being complacent, I think our banking sector has done reasonably well. Are there more banks possible? We would be delighted. But they've got to come in on the basis that is subject to the sound regulation and the rules of the game. So we would not allow banks into the system that do not meet the criteria. And that's a challenge, because it's a big capital requirement, and that's why you've got the differentiated approach around cooperative banking as well as big banking and small banking. But if they meet the criteria, welcome. But again, it's part of the challenges. And don't forget, most of the foreign banks are here, but they're much more in the business banking side, in the personal wealth side, and in the investment banking side. They're not at the retail bank level, because our banks are very extensively in that market and very effective. What we should also perhaps look at is for infrastructure. Yes, we are importing for infrastructure, because some of the things we don't make ourselves, so you need to import it. If you recall a few years ago when the rand was very strong, we were saying, use the opportunity of a strong currency to do your imports for your infrastructure spend, because you take advantage of that at that point in time. You don't want to be importing your infrastructure requirements when your currency is depreciating, because it costs you much more. So part of the challenge is that kind of timing, but that is up to those who are importing, and part of it's infrastructure. Really, I think the details I'm sure you have in different committees, because that is about Eskom, it's about Transnet, it's about your roads, your electricity. And as we've said, unless you have the ability to get your goods to market efficiently, effectively, on time, it's not only the amount of time, it's that it's on time. You know it's going to take X amount of days, it must take X amount of days, and so on. And this is hugely important for us, because the benefit of the infrastructure is not just the counter-cyclical opportunity that it's impacting on the economy at a time of slow growth. It improves the economic efficiency going forward, so that when the economy and the globe comes out of these problems, you're able to pick up your efficiencies and effectiveness, because you've put better infrastructure in place. So your ability to get goods to the ports, for the ports to be efficient, to take less time, and so on, is extremely important. So it's a lot. To me, it's the imports, the reason for the imports, and Chris has said, the vast majority is for infrastructure, is that it gives you economic benefit going forward. It builds the economic efficiency of your capacity in your society. So it's extremely important around that. The question of quite a number of you have referred to the question of China. Now, yes, China does import cheap goods, but that's got to be looking at in whether your trade policy and so on. I think we should think about this slightly differently. You know, if you look at it, China has a lot of interest on the African continent and a relationship with almost all the African countries. Is there not an opportunity for a win-win working with China to look at the big questions down the line? Because the challenges that we have, that China has, that we all have here, is that, you know, some of the jobs that China now, its workforce is also changing, are the opportunities for those that work to be done here? And can we look at it in a strategic sense long term, that there's a benefit for all of our countries working together to look at your energy, your food resource, your question of the three things that you need, which is, if a long-term view is taken and you look at it in partnerships, we could help transform the infrastructure. What is the challenge that we have on the African continent? We can produce the goods, we can't get them to market, right? So how do we build that infrastructure together in a cohesive way? And I think that's one of the challenges that we should be facing as a country, is what is that role in partnership, not just with Africa, but with SADC, with the CMA, and with Sub-Saharan Africa. Say, where do we go to from here? Do they bank with us? Do they pay that? That would be something that this is a shop. The revenue services would be looking at all of these things to see that everybody is compliant. So if there is somebody who is not paying that or whatever, I'm quite sure that should be an alert that goes to the National Treasury to say, guys, these are people who are not paying their fair share of tax. And the tax regime is not something that we're involved with the central bank, but you know the efforts around the National Treasury and everybody paying their fair share and ensuring that we get compliance. Tax compliance is a big issue for us, and it's something that the Treasury and the SARS has worked on for a long time. So if people are aware of people who are not paying tax, you know, advise Treasury. I'm quite sure that they would be looking at ways to tighten the system all the time and see that everybody pays their fair share. In terms of the point you made about the BRICS and establishing a central bank, they're not establishing a central bank. What the BRICS is looking at is establishing a BRICS development bank. That would fall under the Treasury, not ourselves. And it's simply, it's again a means by which you would find an additional resource once they've determined the amount of money that would go into the development bank that development initiatives in the BRICS countries could then tap into. So it's another source of funding and another resource, which is, again, very helpful. So the benefits around it are very big. What you're seeing with ourselves, for instance, we've signed an agreement with China, and Zodwa could perhaps add on that in relation to the reserves accumulation, is that we now have an agreement with China that we can invest in the renminbi as a reserve, as a portion of our currency. But what you're seeing, for instance, the agreement between Brazil and China is different. Brazil and China have reached an agreement in which they can use their own currencies for trade, so that they would not be paying in dollars, they would be paying in the Brazilian currency or the Chinese currency. Now, obviously, that's something that we could look at down the line as well. But we have ongoing discussions with the Central Bank of China in relation to that. And then part of it is whether we can look at a question of creating a reserve pool. One of the agreements from the BRICS was creating a reserve pool. So that, well, it's not a reserve amount. It's not really a pool. It's not a pool. It's a reserve amount that would say that we could access, so that if there were issues that you needed some currency support, you could go to this arrangement and you could be given an amount of money, so that it's an additional resource, so that if you're finding that you are having some pressures, you need some additional currency, you can actually go into this reserve arrangement and be able to draw some funds from that. That is an agreed in principle among the BRICS countries to create that reserve resource. So I think they're all very good initiatives that would benefit all the countries, in particular ourselves. So I think those are very good. Private sector credit, it's gross fixed capital formation, I think, and perhaps some other issues for yourself. And then on the banking and small banking and so on.
Well, let me try to address the questions about investment and FDI. I mean, you know, I think the experience of South Africa has shown that FDI tends to be very lumpy. So these are money flows in because companies want to purchase a company here or set up an investment here, but these are very structured one-off investments. And so if you look at FDI over time, they're, you know, will come in one quarter. Third quarter of last year, there's 22 billion rands worth of FDI growth, and in the fourth quarter, there was a small outflow. So, you know, FDI numbers in economies that grow much more quickly across the board, where all sectors are growing, will be much more stable, and the rate of FDI inflow will be much higher than in South Africa. Yes, it is related to things like confidence and trust, but I think it's also related to harder economic factors like, you know, what are we investing in? Is there a long-term market for this product that we're investing in? How fast is that market going to grow over time? Where's the competition come from, et cetera, et cetera? So I think FDI decisions tend to be pretty hard-nosed economic decisions that firms take about whether or not they want to invest in a place. It's also, I think, true that FDI is impacted a lot by the general competitiveness of the economy. So you will get more FDI in South Africa into places like the financial sector, because the financial sector is seen to be a very competitive sector relative to financial sectors in other parts of the world. You may not get a lot of investment FDI into other sectors that aren't seen to be as productive or competitive. We can certainly send you the long-term FDI numbers so you can get a sense of how lumpy those numbers actually are. On the gross fixed capital formation, private sector investment last year came out at about 3.8%, which is considerably weaker than we thought it would. That, yes, again, is very much a function of confidence and trust and forward-looking perspectives about economic growth, which aren't terribly positive. And we would certainly expect to see much stronger private sector investment if confidence was higher, if investors felt that they would realize their returns more rapidly, if they felt that they were investing, if they were investing in in long-term areas where they thought there was serious market growth. And I think the factors that prevent them from taking a positive view on that now span the range of international factors that the governor was speaking of. So if I'm producing in South Africa but exporting to Australia or Europe, the prospects look quite bad. And so your decision to invest and therefore pump up the growth fixed capital formation numbers are weaker. So I think that's what's driving some of those types of factors are driving the private sector decisions. On the government and public sector corporation side, those are longer-term decisions. To invest in municipal infrastructure on the general government side in particular. And so general government capital investment has been growing at quite a nice pace over quite a long time. There was a brief hiccup, I think, in 2009 where it declined, or 2010. But last year it grew at about 10%. It should grow at about 10% this year. Public sector corporations, those are very large investment decisions, very large amounts of capital. And the two biggest ones are Eskom and Transnet, and they are spending quite a lot of money. And that is money that's programmed in over substantial periods of time, and those growth rates will be expected to be higher. From a growth perspective, we certainly would want to see growth fixed capital formation covering both the private sector, general government, and the public sector corporations to be considerably higher. In the 2005-2007 period, I think it was running about 12-13%. We would certainly like to see it go back to those kinds of rates of growth to get a good growth rate for the South African economy as a whole. So obviously these are really important issues. And there's quite a lot of weakness on the private sector side, for sure. I wanted to make a comment about China over time. One of the big discussions about China is how the economy rotates away from being a primarily investment and export-led economy to one that's more focused on household consumption. And the Chinese government has announced a whole range of plans to change policies, reform policies, to try to encourage that rotation away from exports and investment to consumption. I shouldn't say away from investment. It will be towards a different type of investment. But the sort of conventional view out there is that this is a process that takes a long time. What's important about it, I think, for us is that over time, as it rotates away from exports and to consumption, is that the Chinese currency's real effective exchange rate will rise, and it's risen quite a lot over the last 4 or 5 years. It will continue to rise strongly in future, and that will be a benefit to those concerned about the alacrity with which South Africans buy Chinese imports. Let me just finish with one comment about low interest rates and GDP. I think it's fair to say that the monetary transmission mechanism in recent years is not working quite the way one would have expected it to have worked prior to the crisis. And so with low interest rates, the demand for loans, the demand for credit across households and firms is lower than one would expect it to be. And so low interest rates aren't necessarily having quite the growth effect that one would want them to have. Thanks.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Just a few questions on banking. Maybe to start with the question on whether foreign banks... is it away? Okay. Start off with a question that says that when there are foreign investment or companies coming from the foreign countries, are they the banks coming from those countries as well? Are they regulated in South Africa? Typically, what happens is that most of the corporates that have offshore operations, the local banks there would follow their activities. Just an example here is that if MTN is going to be finding its way into Nigeria, and that MTN's corporate banker in South Africa is Standard Bank, you would typically find that Standard Bank would also follow MTN in Nigeria. That happens as well with Chinese companies or even Indian companies. Now, the governor mentioned that the most prominent banks are the big four, maybe big five if you include Investec, but we have 37 registered banks in South Africa. The others would be small specialist banks. The known ones are African Bank and Capitec. But then we've got a whole range of other foreign banks as well, like JP Morgan, HSBC, some Chinese banks, the CCB, the Chinese and the Construction Bank of China, as well as the Bank of India and many other Indian companies, Indian banks. So to answer then your question directly is that when we register those banks in South Africa, we regulate them according to the standard of South Africa. So let's take for an example that we are one of the banks is Bank of America, and in South Africa we've implemented Basel III, but in the US they still have Basel I. We then regulate that Bank of America's operation in South Africa in terms of Basel III. So we apply the higher standard, and because we've applied, we've implemented Basel III, all registered banks in South Africa, all 37 of them, are registered in terms of Basel III, which is the higher of. Now, it does happen that those banks, when they consolidate their operations back home, they would consolidate it in terms of the local regulations, which would be lower, let's say, but in South Africa, for our own purposes, they've got to be sufficiently regulated by our standard. Then the question of confidence and trust. One of the ways in which you ensure confidence and trust in the financial system is your ability to sustain a normal functioning of the financial system in the context of a global crisis. Now, as the governor referred to this point earlier on, we haven't our banking system or our insurance companies have never had to request for any bailout, even under the context of a financial crisis. Now, I wouldn't want to be an employee of a central bank in any other country than in South Africa at the moment, because this is the only time when one is able to go to sleep and not be woken up by the governor asking about whether we've got liquidity support for one of the major companies. That can be a hugely stressful situation. As we have shown in the graphs, the impact into South Africa is that it slows credit, it slows lending, it slows financial activity, but liquidity remains tight. You may have read in the newspapers or just a lot of public coverage that part of South Africa's problem is that we've got lots of liquidity in the market. Companies are cash flush, banks are cash flush, they are not lending, and that is as best as you can get in a financial system that is stable. Now, you know that you've got financial stability if you are able to go through a financial crisis without having to provide any fiscal or monetary support to the financial companies. You also know that you've got financial stability if, in case of distress of any of the one banks or any of the or one of the financial companies, you are able to manage that bank out of a financial system without causing major disruption to the normal functioning of the financial system, or without slowing down any lending or bring about any major cost or lending into the system. In South Africa, we've got that, so we can say that we are managing a relatively stable financial system. Then there is a question about the number of banks. Are they too few, as the governor has said? I just want to clarify. The governor was referring here to the effect that the crisis has. When any financial system gets into trouble, what we do as central banks is that we call the executives of the large corporations, of the large banks, into the room somewhere and say that we've got a problem with that and that bank. Would you be able that by Monday when we open the doors, you can be able to make an announcement that we have subsumed the bank or bought this asset or that asset or something like that? So the crisis has got that effect because it creates a lot of mergers, a lot of takeovers over on the small banks, especially the small and medium banks that find themselves in trouble. Then we manage the crisis like that. But the downside to that strategy is that then you end up with very large Fed banks, because they would have subsumed all the others. And then you've created a consequential problem in the sense that you might have created monsters whom, if they were to get into distress, then you will have nothing to do to be able to solve them by. The assets of these banks tend to be so large that they can be the size of the GDP of the country at any given stage, that even if you wanted to help them, you would simply not have the fiscal or monetary support to be able to help them out. So that's what she was referring to. In the case of South Africa, though, Of course, we can do with more competition, and this has been an issue that we've had for a very long time. As an ordinary member, of course, you want to see a lot more competition. I think that the terrain is changing now, because if you look at those numbers on unsecured lending, the problem is not that people don't get loans. The problem is that people get too much loans. Now, when you speak to the banks, this is a highly contested terrain at the moment, because yes, we've got two specialist bankers, which are Capitec and Able, but the big banks are also getting into the market big time. So it's not small amounts there. The growth there is not only with respect to the small ones, but the larger ones as well. So there is a lot of competition with respect to the unsecured lending. With respect to the deposits, one of the effects of Basel, which I will say a little bit about in the future, is that it is forcing banks to fund themselves with long-term savings, because one of the lessons of the crisis is that if you rely too much on short-term credit where people can easily go to withdraw their money, that puts you into trouble, because if there is any announcement of any distress in a bank, it is those short-term deposits that have a very high run-off rates, because people know they can withdraw the money. So why wait until you can no longer withdraw the money, so they will run on the bank? So Basel III then says you've got to diversify your funding base so that it is not only the small the short-term deposits that you fund yourself on, but long-term deposits as well. What that will do for us in South Africa is that it will promote savings. It will make sure that people don't just keep current accounts deposits, but they invest in long-term deposit instruments such as the unit trust or collective investment schemes and so on, which is a good thing. This part of the Basel III hasn't been implemented, but just as a conclusion on the issue of competition is that members of the public like I would complain when the bank charges are high. But members of parliament will complain when there's too much debt going into the people in the form of unsecured lending. It's a balance that you have to strike. There is a cost to borrowing, as you know, so there is a form of blend of cost that you need to take. So what that correct balance is quite difficult to strike. But at the moment, I would say that competition is taking place. We see a lot of lending in unsecured lending. We see a lot of competition for deposits. Every time you open your Sunday newspaper, I'm sure you'd find a very large advert from one of the big four that says, we'll give you so much interest rate. We'll even give you an iPad someday if you bring your money with us. So competition is really taking place big time there. The issue of the too big to fail and the deposit insurance and the specialist banks are part of what we resolved in the form of Basel III. We have implemented Basel III with respect to the 1st of January 2013. There are other countries as well that have implemented in the emerging economies. Indonesia is one of them. India is another. And then with respect to the major ones, Australia and Canada have implemented. The US and the UK, and Europe largely have not yet announced the implementation of Basel III. But Basel III is nothing but a new regulatory framework that seeks to do three things. Firstly, require banks to hold more capital in terms of volume. Secondly, require banks to hold better capital in terms of the quality of capital. And lastly, to manage the liquidity in the banking system, to make sure that there are sufficient liquidity buffers, both in normal times as well as in times of distress. So it introduces some very intuitive forms of regulation, such as requiring banks to hold more capital when the economy is growing, and to be able to eat out of that capital when the economy is going down, so that when the economy is slowing down, they don't look out for capital, but because they would have built sufficient buffers for those. But also to create additional capital for those banks that are too big to fail. So in South Africa, the way that the governor has referred to the question of banks that are too big to fail, we will impose capital charges for those banks that are simply too big. So the more you grow your assets, the higher the capital requirement, and that tends to be a very effective form of regulation. An example I would like to give here is that capital is a very expensive form of funding. So if you charge, if as a central bank you charge higher capital for the banks to do certain activities such as, let's say, proprietary trading, which is trading that you do on your own balance sheet, take risk-taking on the different interest rates or exchange rates or commodity prices using depositors' money that you could lose in there. Capital charges is very high, so most banks would simply just stop that activity because it just doesn't make sense. You will make the profit, let's say, of 100 rands, but the capital you're required to hold is 120 rands. So what's the point? There's no point of doing that. So again, in a way of just controlling that, the fact that the banks would not be too big to fail, that would be the issue. The issue of the foreigners taking their money back home and the issue of the anti-money laundering activities, it's highly unlikely that this is the case unless they carry loads of cash back home. It is true that many of them don't find their way into the banking system because, as you know, if you go into a bank and you open an account, you're required to bring your proof of residence and all other documentations required of the banks to know you as a client. We issue those regulations that require banks to understand their clients and to know where they get their monies from and how they use their monies from. In the case of illegal immigrants, then it's almost impossible for them to do that because they won't be able to do that. There are some thresholds that allow some one-off transactions where you can come once off to deposit a certain amount of money below a certain threshold and you can be allowed to do that. But if you come often, then you have to be captured into the system and that's what happens. But the controls at the airport and at the ports are simply too difficult for any amount of significant cash that can be taken out of the system. So even though there is a lot of economic activity taking place, I doubt that any form of illegal removal of cash into outside of South Africa happens at any significant scale. If it does happen, it will probably simply be circulating within the country, but not through the banking system. And then lastly, on the issue of the Stokvels, perhaps the best place to manage credit risk is those financial activities that take place at the communities, because lending doesn't happen by some form of a mathematical model that defines whether you'll be able to pay back your money. It happens on the basis of your surname and who you're known at in the communities. And we find that in the credit risk is the lowest, as the governor has said, where cooperative banks are concerned and Stokvels are concerned. Because if you don't pay your money, people know where you stay, they know what your surname is. There's a huge community embarrassment that comes with it. Some of the cooperative banks that we have registered, we currently have two at the moment, one in the Zobotla, which is a village in the northwest, the other in Orania Kass. For both of them, credit risk is significantly low, much lower than you would find in the cooperative banks. We have a lot of Stokvels, and we do encourage Stokvels to come and actually register as a cooperative bank. The advantage you get by being registered as a cooperative bank is that then you've got a protection, an implicit protection of the taxpayer, because your activities would have been regulated normally, so that if any loss may occur, which is highly unlikely, but if any loss may occur, you at least have got that guarantee as any other normal depositor in the commercial banks. So we do encourage those. We do have about 26 financial cooperatives which are not yet registered as cooperative banks, but whom we have given an exemption from the Banks Act to be able to operate. And that's, for us, would rather have registered cooperative banks than CFIs, because at least we've got oversight over the activities they do. Thanks.
To get back to the issue that the governor raised regarding the diversification of our reserves into the renminbi. Until recently, all our reserves were invested in currencies of major economies. Our cooperation with China enabled us to negotiate the possibility of diversifying into the renminbi. That is not only advantageous in terms of being prudent, of diversifying, but it also reflects our trade pattern with China. So it's been a good move to have to diversify into currencies that we can at least enhance our return out of. Because as I said earlier, the interest rates in major economies have been close to zero. So when we invest our reserves with them, we get very little. In fact, with some other central banks abroad, if you want to invest your reserves, you actually would be inclined to pay them to put your money with them because they themselves don't want to take additional reserves from other countries. So investing in the renminbi has been very good for our reserves. It helps us at least as register a positive return.
Okay. I guess this was the last round, honorable members. But before I give back to the governor to summarize the key issues that we think we need to actually really focus on into the future, I thought I should just make one or two observations on our part as a community, the things that we need to look into. And probably give a little bit of background. I know on Swaziland I was actually a suspect that probably was taken into confidence on the loan to Swaziland by the committee. But there are things that I would know from the onset that if we try to discuss them here, we'll not be able to get the correct responses, because in both instances, both Zimbabwe and Swaziland, if I just want to make an assertion, Governor, is that whilst issues are still being discussed between the two governments, somebody jumps the gun elsewhere. Even in the case of Swaziland. And I believe the minister has a responsibility to brief Parliament through this committee. But they can only do so if they are certain of the details of what they are going to talk about or they are going to land, if there's going to be such a decision. Again, in the case of Swaziland, we picked it up in the media. It didn't come from the South African government. It came out from Swaziland, that issue. Today we're talking Zimbabwe in the newspapers. Tendai Biti says you'll bear the brand of not adhering to our request because our people will vote through their feet and come across. And we discussed that matter of the loan. I think the minister at the right time will come and brief us, and I think that's the request that the committee should make. So I thought I should just make that observation. On way to Governor, I think because you have raised a key question of what lies ahead of us, I think that's the key question that honorable members always, as we go into the medium-term budget policy statement, will be trying to get certainties in terms of the fiscal framework into the future. But you have outlined three key areas that will continue to pose key challenges to the global economy. You referred to this as three-speed economy, the way you define it. The challenges of the U.S. economy and what the U.S. itself does to actually extricate itself out of the situation. I regard this as an exogenous economic factor that we as South Africans, if it was a price, we'll be a price taker, not a price giver. But there are key issues that have not been resolved in there, unless in the past few weeks, 2 weeks, something has happened on the fiscal cliff, which is consumer spending cuts and taxes for a particular bracket. I think this is still a thorny issue. Obviously, how they manage to come out of this thing, it will have an impact on the global economy and the confidence. On the Eurozone, I think from where I'm sitting, the key challenge is that if you characterize their economic policies, there is that they've got a very strong unitary monetary policy. It's a union on the monetary level.
but federal governments. The extent to which these governments can be able to move depends on what the electorate also says to them. In fact, as you see there, in the Eurozone, this arrangement has actually led to more regime changes and many resignations of ministers. Probably Minister of Finance has resigned as a city of another country within Europe. Now, I think these are real challenges to the economy. Now, on our case, the pedestrian growth, which is sluggish growth, it's growth but it's very slow. There are domestic factors which we need to look into. I think those are the issues that have been raised in a number of forums, and our colleagues and comrades here will hear, will know those issues. Energy is one of them. As you say, manufacturing and beneficiation. We are contradicting ourselves as South Africa on energy policy in many ways, particularly on the mining sector. We speak beneficiation, we speak energy savings. And the first thing that we go for is smelters, because they consume lots of electricity. We say, cut electricity consumption. Therefore, there can be beneficiation in that area. Let alone the issue that you have raised, that we have got miners and engineers in South Africa. It's a very important observation that you have made, that we don't have value add in terms of skills that would actually make our people to be jewelry makers and so on and so forth. So we've got more engineers to intervene in terms of shafts and other things elsewhere in the world and here to think the best, to develop or build the best mines. But in terms of taking that raw material forward, we're not doing very, very well. But I think it's one thing that we need to look into in terms of our own infrastructure development, rail and so on and so forth, because we're still focusing on Guha, which still says to me, our mindset is that we should export primary products rather than to beneficiate sufficiently so in the country. The last point, the governor of Nigeria is not a very popular country to make an example of, but probably 2 weeks ago, he made some very important observation about Africa and China. And I think that's the point that within BRICS we should focus on as South Africa. He said African countries should stop romanticizing China. It might be a very strong word. I don't agree with that. But what he means is that we should actually relate with China as partners in development. And as you travel through Africa, you'd see that China is doing a lot of work in Africa. But as to whether we are beginning to use our relationship with China in BRICS and take the current situation to our own advantage to negotiate in terms of food security, that our products enter European markets, you know, at favorable rates. I don't think we're at that level, but I believe at some forums these things will be ironed out. I'm saying so because, Governor, if you drive from Lusaka on road, not fly, drive, right to the border of Katanga province, Chito and so on and so forth, there's just a flurry of food products, agricultural products, and I think you'll see them even in South Africa. But there is a stampede for maize supply, even in the continent itself. But I think land is being utilized effectively and maximally so. The key issue is whether the products that come from the agricultural sector find their way into the real markets. And I think that's a key issue that we really need to look into. So I thought I should make this few observations out of this deliberation and hand over to you, Governor. Thank you.
Thanks very much, and thanks for those observations. I think that certainly those are the areas of focus. Perhaps, I don't want to summarize what we've discussed, except to say that these are very challenging times, and we need to ensure that we don't do things by rote. We need to think about what we're doing and why, and are we effective in what we do as a country, as a whole, and ensure that we have the cohesion of policy and the focus, because we are affected by what we all say and do. And I think that's extremely important, because we could be and we should be a destination of choice. South Africa has a lot going for us. We really do have a lot going for us. And sometimes I think we allow our own internal wranglings as a country to dominate in a manner that loses sight of actually what's happening. So for me, it really is about taking some of the tough decisions that we need to take about who we are and where we're going, and the cohesion of policy and the coordination of what we want to do, and to recognize that to be effective, sometimes you're going to have to make shorter-term sacrifices for longer-term gains. And that's something that we really do need to better understand and work with. We are really committed to working with our colleagues on the continent. We participate both in the CMA and in SADC, which we chair. We look at the question of trying to ensure that there is a focus on a regional approach and the economic efficiencies that we can work together on, because as we know, is that the region is growing extremely well, and many countries are growing at 5 to 7%. And this is the story of the future. If we can ensure that we cement the infrastructure requirements, the coordination, and ability to have the trade that we want in the interests of all. Certainly in Nigeria, we have good working relations with the central bank, and we will be visiting them. They have been here a number of times, and we've had bilateral meetings with them, and we will be visiting them this year as well. And just in that sense, I think that's to perhaps again offer that we meet more often and come and talk to you more often. And I would, you know, our annual general meeting takes place towards the end of July. We would then have our annual report out, and once we've released the annual report, obviously it gets tabled in Parliament. And we're certainly happy to come and present and answer any questions that you would have around the annual report. The annual report contains a review of monetary policy, which is a prime responsibility that we have, as well as it shows you sort of all the operational tasks that we have and what we do. So we would be very happy to meet with you on that and go through the annual report with you, and perhaps to have an ongoing discussion about what is happening in the economy from our perspective and the role that we play within that. You know, South Africa, especially both as a country, but also within different elements within that, whether it's the Treasury or the Central Bank, certainly as the Central Bank, we participate in a huge number of international forums and continental regional forums that I think are vital to the long-term success of South Africa and the way in which we try to participate and ensure that our views are also heard. You know, as South Africa, we're really the only African country in a lot of these forums. And therefore, the role that we play and the way we express ourselves and what we see and so on is something that the country as a whole should be aware of. And these opportunities of meeting with yourself help us to be accountable in the way that we feel we should be, and to ensure that the public, through yourselves, is also much more aware of the role of the central bank. So thank you for the opportunity. I hope this has been useful to you. The slides are available, and so that, you know, they can be electronically available to you and then to all of you. And on an ongoing basis, we really do look forward to an active engagement with yourself. And also thank you very much for inviting members of Parliament and other committees, not just the Finance Committee, because I think everybody today is interested in what's happening in the economy, and not just the specialist committees that have to deal with it. So on behalf of all of us, thank you very much.
Thanks, Governor. I didn't mention other chairpersons, but I also note the chairperson of Labour. When we deal with the domestic front of our economy, is very, very important. Thank you very much, Governor, and your team. And certainly the information that you've shared with us will help us in deliberations as we go into the votes of our budget in Parliament. Thank you very much. Thank you, honourable members.
The woman is not there.
Okay. Thank you.
Gracias.